It's just so weird to be here on a Friday afternoon in South Park. There's nobody here. I don't know if they're all away at Tahoe over the weekend or all the companies shut down.
San Francisco writer Paulina Borsuk and I recently discovered that we go way back. We were both in the same Berkeley philosophy class in 1974 with teaching assistant Stephen Weed, who was Patty Hearst's boyfriend, and classmate Jerry Mathers from Leave It to Beaver. Like a lot of us humanities types, Paulina drifted to technology. Her book, Cyber Selfish, is a sharp-tongued critique of digital culture, a culture whose capital was right here in South Park. Today, this block-long South of Market oasis is a tree-lined, sun-dappled ghost town. The posh addresses are for lease. Echo, the restaurant where every table was a deal in the making, is closed.
I'm trying to figure out how to articulate this. It's like everybody saw themselves as a Midtown Manhattan advertising exec. You know, I mean, that is what this whole scene really reminded me of. It's like a city taken over by Midtown Manhattan advertising.
Maybe that's why those of us who have lived in the Bay Area for 20 years felt like we'd been invaded by a bunch of aliens.
Well, we were invaded by a bunch of aliens. I mean, that's exactly what happened. I mean, that is exactly what happened.
San Francisco was always a place where you could be hip without being rich. Good weather, lots of little cafes. It was a great place to be a musician, a writer, an artist, even a public radio producer. That all changed with the dot-com boom. A friend's 29th birthday party at one of the latest designer restaurants introduced me to the new hip San Franciscans, table-hopping 20-somethings, guzzling $50 bottles of wine, and bellowing like, well, like a bunch of future millionaires.
I really had a year of exceptionally high salary.
I met Chris Manners at a margarita party filled with former employees of Expedior, the recently imploded web consultants. Back in the 80s, you might have caught Chris playing rock and roll in a pink bunny suit at the arty clubs that dotted the South of Market. Another humanities type. In the late 90s, like me, Chris got sucked into the internet boom, leaving his comfy magazine job for the chic and the money of the web.
Basically, I hated it in the end. It was really not my thing. But, you know, as I was saying, I got a new fridge out of it. A big black fridge with the water in the front.
Black fridge?
Black fridge with water in the front, you know. And
got it. Water in the front.
Yeah, and ice. Crushed or cubed. So, you know, major expenditure. Basically, financed a good $5,000 worth of household furnishings for me out of that.
While Manners was upgrading his lifestyle, a couple of partners and I were starting a company to produce audio for the web. We showed our carefully diagrammed cocktail napkin to some wealthy Taiwan investors, and suddenly our company was worth $10 million. Then came the crash, and unfortunately, I never got that fridge. I had a better run in the last boom, the art boom, that first made the South of Market a hip destination. Art was the internet of the 80s, fueled by a paradoxical mixture of Gen X anti-materialism and the distant glimmer of booming New York art prices. If no business in the 90s was too weird to be wedded to the web, no South of Market restaurant, club, or cafe in the 80s was complete without an art theme. Little galleries and art venues were everywhere. Everybody had some kind of project.
That's absolutely right. That's exactly
well,
right.
Well, it's just to say that I...
That's right.
I had a late night radio show at the time and decided, naturally, that I was a sound artist. This intriguing work consists of people I'm interviewing by telephone waiting for me to stop talking.
I guess I'm having a little difficulty getting this clear.
And here's a visit from Walter Alter, a mod scooter mechanic by day, who lived in his garage, the Bat Cave, and visited our studio one night with a towering rack of malfunctioning boomboxes. At one point, I did a series of sound installations at a club called Nine. Reasoning that patrons of the noisy nightclub would never stand still for a sound installation, I put them in the bathrooms. Upstairs, Nine had turned a former hooker's motel into an installation space called the Art Motel, with each individual room transformed into an art experience. Lots of machines and meat, queer activism, feminist outrageousness, and of course, the popcorn room, complete with abusive clown. All this time, nobody was making any money. It was all a bunch of black-clad refuseniks creating their own world of higher purpose and self-expression in the midst of the Reagan 80s. But everybody knew that just across Market Street, the downtown art dealers were making a killing.
Easy money. It was easy, easy money.
My old neighbor Don Soker's gallery specialized in contemporary Japanese art. But there was an international art boom going on in the late 80s, and Don found a niche selling American work to investment-hungry Japanese.
You know, I was like such a small player in this whole thing, and I sold over $1 million in 1 year. People were throwing money at you. I mean, here.
Don was moving so much art to Japan, I think the correct verb would be shoveling. Often he wouldn't even open the crates when they arrived from New York. He just replaced the return dress with his own and sent them on to Japan, where they no doubt sit in vaults to this day, waiting to recover their value.
Sales contracts from Japan here, $51,000. These are
that was for an Andy Warhol.
Yeah, this is $12,000, $15,000, $20,000.
These are prints.
These are prints. Yeah, your Schnabel, $7,500, edition 5, all unique. Invoices after invoices, $12,000 for 2 Schnabel prints. And these are so, I remember selling these prints, you know, they were on velvet. They were on velvet. And, of course, they couldn't get enough of them, you know?
International art prices were through the roof. When the San Francisco Museum of Modern Art joined the fray and purchased one of Julian Schnabel's huge broken crockery on tarpaulin works, the San Francisco Chronicle's art critic Kenneth Baker advised them to sell it before the price fell, which is what the lucky ones did with their dot-coms. A good subject to take up with Paulina Borsuk. Do you have do you have favorite failed dot-coms?
Well, I have to go with eye dry cleaning because this is one that I made up when we were goofing one day. And then much to my horror and shock, I realized that somebody had come up with this idea. And it was called, actually, purpletie.com. Then it failed, of course. But he got $30 million in venture funding. So I love eye dry cleaning because I feel like I made it up. I summoned it into existence, and then it died.
Yes, that's very amusing. Except for the died part. I like to think my own little internet venture isn't really dead. It's just resting. Remember, when you're laughing at our business plan, we didn't steal that money. It wanted to come with us. The mass hallucination that briefly brought pet food and dry cleaning to the web was no more improbable than an art motel. Of course, the South of Market art boom was a scene, a kind of exhilarating, high-concept party that didn't really change much of anything. The dot-com boom was a real economic bubble. It made people wealthy. It drove rents through the roof. And most awfully, it obliterated that little bit of bohemian romance that you could be real if you weren't getting rich. As the U-Hauls queue up now to leave San Francisco, it's clear that the dot-com boom has changed everything.
It's left such wreckage. I mean, just because the people are picking up and going back to the Midtown Manhattan advertising firms where they always belonged in the first place doesn't do anything about the people who already have been chased out of town. Those people, once they're gone, are not coming back. You know, and once a building has been flipped and the new owner has to service his or her mortgage at a ridiculous, you know, monthly whatever because they bought at the top of the market, you know, the normal middle-class person who used to live there can't come back and rent it. So the social structure is so frayed, and I sometimes feel like I'm wandering around Harry Lime's Vienna, you know, the third man, post-World War II Vienna. There's a post-apocalyptic feeling to me around here these days.
In San Francisco, I'm John Rieger.